The Sleep Insight series invites listeners to learn about this amazing adventure we take every night called sleep. Through these insightful discussions, we examine sleep and our society's beliefs about sleep from a variety of angles. We hope you'll learn some cool new facts and analogies that you can use to help us raise awareness about this underappreciated one-third of our lives. Welcome to Project Sleep's podcast. Project Sleep is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to raising awareness and advocating for sleep health, sleep equity, and sleep disorders. I'm your host, Julie Flygar. We're so glad you're here as we work together towards making sleep cool. On this podcast, all guests express their own opinions. While medical diagnoses and treatment options are discussed for educational purposes, this information should not be taken as medical advice. Each person's experience is so unique, which is why it's so important to always consult your own medical team when making decisions about your own health. If you haven't done so yet, please hit the subscribe button so you never miss a Project Sleep podcast episode. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave us a rating or review wherever you listen, so that we can reach more listeners and raise more awareness.
I'm grateful to be your host for this really important conversation. So why this conversation? Well, from ergonomic pillows to melatonin gummies, Americans are spending $65 billion annually on the pursuit of a good night's sleep. But unfortunately, for those living with a chronic sleep condition, it doesn't matter how good your mattress is. There will be unresolved issues and serious, even life-threatening health complications are real possibilities. So how do we bridge this gap between helpful tips and finding help for those with an undiagnosed sleep condition? Well, that's why our incredible gathering of medical professionals, patient advocates, and people living with sleep disorders are here to share their important insights with us. So without further ado, let me introduce our first two panelists. Julie Flygar serves as the president and CEO of Project Sleep. She is an internationally recognized patient perspective leader, an accomplished advocate, and the award-winning author of Wide Awake and Dreaming, a memoir of narcolepsy. And her TEDx talk, What You Can Learn from a Professional Dreamer, is an absolute must-watch. Dr. Shelby Harris is in private practice in White Plains, New York, where she specializes in the use of cognitive behavior therapy, or CBT, for anxiety and depression. She is a board certified in behavioral sleep medicine by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine and treats a wide variety of sleep disorders using evidence-based non-pharmaceutical treatments. And if you are not following either of these incredible women on Instagram, please do so now. You will learn something every day and you will definitely laugh. So thank you so much for both of you for joining me right now.
Thanks, Lindsay. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Lindsay.
Absolutely. So let's kick this off. Shelby, this is a conversation about sleep disorders. And for those who are new to this conversation or missed that day in med school, can you tell us what are sleep disorders?
So sleep disorders is a very wide kind of array of different issues that could happen. But essentially, a sleep disorder is where there's a problem with ability to sleep well, right? Whether it's quantity of sleep, quality of sleep that you're having, or the timing of your sleep, or how it makes you feel during the day. So maybe whatever sleep you're getting at night is not refreshing enough because of quality issues, that then you're having issues with excessive sleepiness during the daytime. So it can encompass many different areas. It could be, for example, insomnia. So that's someone who has trouble falling asleep, staying asleep, awakening earlier than they want, any of that combination. And even when they try, they just can't sleep enough. Then there's issues with hypersomnia. So we could have different, we could have narcolepsy type 1, type 2. We could have hypersomnia issues like idiopathic hypersomnia. And then there's things like talking about like apnea, right? So that's the quality of the sleep that you're having. There's another issue there with apnea that's happening. And then things like movements in your sleep. So it could be sleep REM behavior disorder, where you're acting out your dreams essentially, or sleepwalking, sleep talking, grinding your teeth. So there's so many different areas, and you can have more than one, but they all somehow, something will impact timing of sleep, quality of sleep, or the amount of sleep that you're getting and impact your daily functioning in life.
That's super helpful. And 1 in 5 people has some sort of sleep disorder and they're chronically underdiagnosed. So Julie, can you talk to us a little bit about what those diagnosis rates look like?
Yeah, sure. So, with 1 in 5 people living with a sleep disorder, and like you said,
most people aren't really familiar with sleep disorders. It's not something that is honestly much of a part of med school curriculums. Some med schools study sleep for 1 hour of their whole education. And it's really just hasn't been part of our national discourse to be talking about sleep disorders all that much. So when you're experiencing symptoms, whether that's struggling at night or struggling during the day, a lot of that's very invisible, and it leads to people not knowing, first of all, that they could have a sleep disorder. And then once you start talking about it and saying, I think actually something might be wrong, other people not recognizing that you could have a sleep disorder either. So we're looking at delays for narcolepsy specifically of 8 to 15 years on average. That's a really long time. That can be someone's whole high school and college experience completely clouded by this really serious condition that they don't even necessarily know they're dealing with, or they do know, but they're not getting the right answers or going the right direction. So, you know, I think we're looking at also that, you know, 8 to 15 years is for those that are lucky enough to get a diagnosis. They believe that the majority of people living with narcolepsy actually don't even have a diagnosis. And you see, you know, rates of 80 to 90% of people living with sleep apnea not having a diagnosis. So, you know, we often say that Emma and I, who you'll hear from a little bit later, we call it the burning building club, because we feel that people with sleep disorders are like, you know, in a burning building, and we want to get them out. Like, they are living with these serious conditions and don't know it. So we're just really excited to have this conversation and start to help more people getting out of what we say is just like a burning building of sleepiness or, you know, sleep issues.
And I think to add to that, the problem, a big problem is our society, right? So there's this bit, there's a lot of like how you feel during the day. If you're sleepy, you're tired, your sleep isn't refreshing, then there's a lot of people say, you know what, that's life nowadays. That's, you know, there's this power through attitude. And so either people don't speak up or they just get dismissed a lot of times because the idea is that you just have to power through and just deal with it, which is not right.
Here are some sleep tips that I have heard a lot recently. Limit exposure to screens, avoid large meals, caffeine, and alcohol before bedtime, and get regular exercise. Now, for someone like me who has two sleep disorders, not that this is a competition, but I know that some sunshine during the day is probably not going to fix my narcolepsy condition. But Shelby, for somebody who's undiagnosed or struggling with their sleep, what's missing from these articles and even potentially harmful for people?
Yeah, so that's a super common thing and that I hear all the time. And the thing with sleep hygiene recommendations, one of my colleagues, Rachel Mamber, I will never forget, she said this years and years ago, and it really has stuck with me for all this time. She said, sleep hygiene is like dental hygiene. So it's helping to keep things. It's like if you were to brush and floss every day, you're helping to prevent a cavity from possibly happening. But it doesn't mean that you're not going to get a cavity. And once you get the cavity, you can try and brush and floss it away as much as you want. It ain't going to fix the cavity. It might help it from getting worse, but it's not going to fix it. And that's how we have to think about sleep hygiene. Is that sleep hygiene, yes, having wine right before bed is not going to help most people with their sleep quality. And maybe, you know, having a big 2-liter bottle of soda right before bed might not necessarily be ideal either, but that's not going to fix the vast majority of sleep disorders. So we always want sleep hygiene as being a baseline because it's never a bad thing to follow. Although sometimes people get a little too rigid with it, in my opinion. It's not a bad thing to follow, but it's not going to fix a sleep disorder. So a lot of the recommendations that are out there are really just sleep hygiene recommendations, when in reality, for most studies, when they're looking at treatment for sleep disorders, sleep hygiene recommendations are actually the control group in most of these studies. So it really is not the treatment that we're looking for. It's just kind of that baseline thing. So a lot of times I find that when it's reported in the media, it can be very invalidating to people who have sleep disorders because, well, I have patients come into my practice all the time, like, but I'm not drinking coffee, I'm following all the instructions and nothing's working. And it feels like there's something wrong with them when it's actually the way that the stuff gets reported that's the problem as being the main treatment. So whenever I talk about sleep hygiene, one of my recommendations is always, if these things aren't working after 2 weeks, go see a sleep specialist because it's probably something more going on.
And Julie, can you talk about how journalists could add that in a simple way that's not completely changing the way they report?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the great important recommendation that Shelby just made. And I think there's this sort of this thought that, oh, we've written a sleep article that's just for the general public, And as if that people with undiagnosed sleep disorders just don't know that that article is not for them, you know? And that's not actually true, because you know who's the most motivated to read a sleep article for help? Likely the most motivated person is a person with a sleep disorder, undiagnosed, I'd imagine. And it's not that you know that you have it. So you go, I'm going to go to this article and I'm going to learn more and I'm going to follow these tips. So that is your most motivated audience. So to leave them out and to pretend that that they should know somehow that this article is not for them isn't true. So I think that's just like why I'm so excited that we're having this event. And honestly, this is why I founded Project Sleep, because I love sleep health and that's so important, but also sleep disorders are important. And it's bridging that gap, having that conversation together. And I think, you know, obviously for Project Sleep, we really believe in storytelling, and you'll get to hear from our storytellers. And that's another way that you can integrate this message into your articles, is by including a voice of a real person living with a sleep disorder. Because it turns out that, like, you know, movies like Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo, Rat Race, and other movies, I'm sure, are great storytellers, have other examples of other sleep disorders. They didn't do a great job actually portraying real sleep conditions. So you can show real faces, with permission, of course, of real people living with sleep disorders, share their stories, and of course, mention, as Shelby did, if these tips aren't working for you, seek out support from a sleep specialist.
And that's so important. And one of the sleep disorders that I'm just like hearing a lot more about when I'm on Instagram or like reading articles is insomnia. But I'm hearing it a lot more as like a symptom. Like, I'm experiencing a lot of insomnia right now, or friends telling me that like they have a little bit more insomnia this week than they had last week. And is there a supplement they should be taking? So Shelby, can you talk about what insomnia is and how it's treated?
Yeah. So that's actually the number one, what we were talking about earlier, the number one reason I started my Instagram page is because there was so much misinformation out there about just insomnia treatment. So I wanted to really have evidence-based treatment out there. So insomnia is really either it's trouble falling asleep, like I was saying earlier, falling asleep, staying asleep, or awakening, or a combination earlier than you want, despite the adequate opportunity for sleep. So let's say you're allowing for 7-8 hours in bed, but you just can't get that sleep because you're having trouble with falling asleep or staying asleep. Now, it has to create a problem for you in your life. That's the key. So if the problem could be as simple as, I'm really annoyed that everyone else in my house is asleep and I'm lying there awake. It could be memory, mood issues, concentration during the day, any of that sort of stuff. So it's whatever is bothersome to you. Now, here's the other piece of the diagnosis, and it goes along with what you were saying a minute ago, Lindsay, is that it has to happen at least 3 nights a week for multiple weeks on end to be considered insomnia. And so 3 nights a week of that trouble suggests that, okay, we're in a problematic area now. So the reality is that there's individual variability from night to night for even good sleepers. I don't sleep perfect every single night of the week. So I think in our society, it almost has swung to this idea of optimizing and perfection when it comes to sleep, that you should be out cold every night, all night. That's not real either. So once or twice a week, if you have a little more trouble or it's not as perfect or you don't get as much, that's still okay. It's really thinking about how often it's happening. And if it's going on for at least a month, that short term, if it's going on for at least 3 months, that's actually where we start to think about chronic insomnia. And I like that diagnosis criteria because we're all human beings in today's society, and there's a lot of stress that's going around. And if we have a week that's more off because of a stressor or illness or something, that's okay. We look at it in a larger scheme as opposed to just a week here and there. And when it comes to treatments, there's many different treatments out there. So my area of specialty is cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia, which is a non-medication approach, which really is surprising to many people. And when I do a lot of media events and press, and when people talk with me about it, they're like, where has this treatment been? Why have people not been talking about it? It's like, I've been doing it for 20 years. It's been around. It's the gold standard treatment by American College of Physicians and by sleep medicine. It's just for some reason, we don't talk about it enough. There aren't enough providers, but it's starting to become more of the mainstream. We're talking about it with apps, and there's people like myself and books and stuff out there. And then if that's not enough or not appropriate, then we think about sometimes supplementation. It could be melatonin. There's not a lot of effectiveness with it, but sometimes that will help. And then we think about medication treatments. So there's all different ways that we try to approach it, but we actually try without medication and short-term treatment to treat the problem.
That's super helpful. You touched on something there that I'd love to follow up on, where you talked about sort of diagnosis criteria. And I think sometimes in a place where doctors might not always ask the right questions, and we have the internet at our fingertips. We sometimes go into the doctor and say, I think I have X, which becomes a very easy way to be either dismissed or not actually delve into the problem at hand. And so a lot of these sleep disorders that we're going to talk about have multiple symptoms that are seemingly unrelated. How do you recommend talking to a physician about what's going on with how you're sleeping and also how you feel during the day?
Yeah, I think that what we were to kind of circle back to what we were initially talking about, I think if you go in and you can talk about your issue with your sleep or the quality of your sleep in three different ways. So you can go in and say, I'm having issues with potentially the amount of sleep I'm getting. So talk about the amount. How much are you giving yourself 8 hours in bed and only getting 6 hours, or you're sleeping the entire time and it's not enough even? Is that one thing? The timing of your sleep is something you want to talk about. So are you someone who's an extreme night owl? Are you someone who's working shift work? Is the timing of your sleep not routine and regular? Or do you have to get up earlier, but yet you could still keep sleeping a few extra hours? So amount of sleep, the timing, and then the quality. So how are you feeling from the sleep that you're getting? Is it just not feeling refreshing enough? Do you feel like you're excessively sleepy on and off or throughout the day? That's another thing. And then is there anything else that's going on to possibly get in the way of that quality at night? So any movements, any sleepwalking, are you grinding your teeth? Are you snoring? Any of that stuff could be into the quality as well. And I think that should give the physician hopefully a better picture of what might be going on.
That's super helpful. And Julie,
I just want to add to that really quickly is I think, you know, being able to give tangible examples of how something impacts you during the day, especially for hypersomnia, you know, it's just one thing to say, oh, I feel tired every day, you know, okay. But saying, you know, I was having trouble driving 15 minutes in the morning after a full night's sleep, or I fell asleep, you know, during Thanksgiving dinner with my family, I laid down on the couch, I didn't want to be falling asleep. Giving some of those tangible examples of how it's really, I was just talking to someone recently who said that they're falling asleep at a bar and being kicked out with their friends because people think they're drunk and they're not, they're just so tired. So some of those examples where you can place your sleepiness in a location, I think will also just bring to light how serious it is, because I think I know your next question, which is somewhat about, you know, the seriousness of this and misperceptions. And, you know, with 1 in 5 people, I think that should be enough to have a conversation about sleep disorders. That's a lot of people. But sleepiness, I think, because it can be so invisible, and we don't really like talking about chronic illness in general. We don't like talking about sleep in general. It's something that I think can kind of just ride under the surface really easily. And so I like to just mention to people that, okay, well, if you're one of the 4 in 5 people that doesn't have a sleep disorder, why should you care? And just remember that these are people that are also undiagnosed that are out driving cars around you. And so, you know, if you think about 20% of the population could have a chronic sleep disorder, and let's say 10% are undiagnosed. Well, I looked up the prevalence of red cars on the road, and there's about 8% of cars on the road are red. So every time you drive on the road next time and you see a red car, think that could be a person with an undiagnosed sleep disorder. You might care a little bit more to help other people with the undiagnosed sleep disorder get help, realizing that, you know, these are people that are driving around you, they're working around you, they might be working on you, they could be your dentist, they could be your doctor, you know, they could be in really important positions and they could be undiagnosed with sleep disorder. So I think it's a much more important conversation than everyone realizes.
And on that note, as we wrap this up, that was super insightful. There are some really easy resources on the Project Sleep website beyond the incredible toolkit that you've just put out. Can you just give us an example of a few of those?
Yeah, so we have really wonderful fact sheets about different sleep disorders. We also have videos sharing many different people's stories living with different sleep disorders. We have also a link to the sleep disorder checklist, which is a survey or a screening tool. So it's not a diagnosis by any means, but that's a way that you can take a really quick 25 question survey to see if you could possibly have a sleep disorder. It's a good first step. And also, of course, links to how to find a sleep specialist. And of course, I probably shouldn't forget that we did just launch a new program, the Sleep Helpline. And so we actually have a helpline available. So if you have any questions about your sleep pre-diagnosis or after diagnosis, we have helpline that's there, resource specialists available to answer your questions and help get you in the right direction. Navigating the system is so challenging. So we're really glad to finally have dedicated support there for you to help you find next steps and resources.
And on that note, thank you both so much for that conversation. I am so excited to introduce this next group of speakers to talk about individual sleep disorders and their personal stories.
Are you facing sleep issues or a sleep disorder? Project Sleep is now excited to have the Sleep Helpline, a nonprofit-led free national helpline providing personalized support and resources. You can reach out today to speak with a compassionate resource specialist who will listen and help provide accurate sleep disorders information, resources to help navigate daily living and the healthcare landscape, and connect you with a certified sleep center and patient support organizations. Contact the Sleep Helpline at 1-800-819-2043 or by filling out a form on our website at project-sleep.com.
It is my great honor to introduce Lauren Thomas. Lauren is an advocate, a daughter, and a friend living with narcolepsy with cataplexy. She was diagnosed with narcolepsy at 28 after a long journey of misdiagnosed symptoms, which is why she is passionate about sharing her story to help others. Lauren?
Hi, thanks, Lindsay. My diagnosis story starts at age 15. That is the age I was when I first started complaining to doctors about my sleepiness. My mom can recall driving me to school, and I would be asleep before we even left the driveway. My free periods were spent napping in the student lounge or the nurse's office. I can even remember rushing to finish in-class assignments or quizzes so that I could rest for the rest of the period on my desk. During this time, I was already navigating several doctors, a psychiatrist, and psychologist for anxiety and depression, in addition to the physical rigors of being an elite athlete. I was pretty busy. I felt ashamed and less than my peers. I had an active social life, competed in basketball tournaments around the country on the weekends, and I have a very supportive family, but it seemed like no matter how hard I worked and followed my medication regimen, I always felt like I was a walking zombie most days. I was able to get by in high school, but the once perfectionist student was long gone by graduation. I was really just trying to make it through. For college, I went to Indiana University. Go Hoosiers. I thrived socially, but really struggled academically. With no diagnosed medical condition, I was put in a box and received little sympathy from teachers and deans. I couldn't explain why I was sleeping all day, but able to function at night, when most of the fun on campus was happening. It didn't matter how early I tried to go to bed, my sleep was restless, and no matter what, I couldn't even function to begin my days until well into the afternoon. Once I discovered online and evening classes, I was able to find my stride. Post-college, I started my dream job doing research and trainings on race and gender bias. I was commuting into New York City and was woken up by the train conductor almost every day at the last stop. I felt like my urges to sleep were getting worse, and my trips to the bathrooms for mini naps were becoming more frequent. My boss could tell there was something going on with me and offered me medical leave to figure things out. That was in 2017, and I was not diagnosed with narcolepsy for another 2 years. During this time, I saw countless doctors and specialists and was doing any health hack that I could. Most doctors never took the time to hear my pleas for help. They saw an overweight Black woman with some mental health history and continued to prescribe exercise and/or diet and weight loss and therapy. Finally, a breakthrough happened when I was referred to an endocrinologist by my internist because she was concerned by my levels of exhaustion and rapid weight gain. Fortunately, the endocrinologist was able to think outside the box of just the physical appearance and the stigmas associated with them and suggested a sleep study with a sleep specialist. I was finally diagnosed with narcolepsy in January of 2019. Narcolepsy has been an isolating journey. Reflecting on my story, it became clear that the road to a narcolepsy diagnosis stretched across almost 15 long years. The journey not only required me to navigate the complexities of childhood and young adulthood, but also compelled me to grapple with a profound sense of shame and embarrassment that accompanies the art of concealing my sleepiness, which became a covert operation that involved sleeping in my car during school free periods and finding solace in bathroom stalls for a quick, brief respite. After wading through the labyrinth of sleepiness and the isolation it brought, I am grateful today to stand with a diagnosis and have discovered a sense of community amidst the chaos that defined those years. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for that, Lauren. It is my now great honor to introduce the Reverend Dr. Lisa Cressman. She is an Episcopal priest and the founding steward of Backstory Preaching. Her symptoms of restless leg syndrome began as a teenager. Need to advocate alongside others who suffer from this debilitating sleep disorder. Lisa?
Thank you. So I'm going to ask you to engage in a bit of a thought experiment with me first. So I want you to imagine that it's a beautiful, sunny summer's day and the temperature is perfect. You lay down on the grass, you put your arms behind your head, you cross one pant leg over the other. And just as you begin to doze off, you feel a little bit of a prickle in one calf. You're still half asleep, but you use the other opposite foot to rub that sensation away. So job done, you settle in, you begin to doze again. But annoyingly, now you feel several prickles in the same spot. So you pick up your foot and you rub it a little harder. But still you're sleepy and you're relaxed and you're warm. So you doze off again. But this time, the prickles are more insistent. They're deeper, they're harder, and now it wakes you up completely. So in a bit of a panic, you pull up your pant leg to see what's going on, and you see a river of ants flowing up and down your leg. So you've got to move, you've got to get rid of the ants. So you jump up, you stamp your foot on the ground over and over, you brush away the ants. All right, crisis averted, sun is still warm, and you're still not willing to give up on the possibility of a perfect nap. So you lay back down, but in moments, it starts all over again. You begin to doze off, and now it feels like a single prickle, and then a dozen, and then hundreds. And if you don't get up and keep walking, the ants are going to continue to find your leg and get up on the inside of that pant leg. That's what those of us with restless leg syndrome experience when we relax, usually in the evening. At night when we're going to sleep can also happen during the day. But instead of it being ants trapped between a pant leg and our skin, the feeling is on the inside of our legs. But just like if you get those prickly sensations from an insect and you jump up because you got to move to get rid of them, that's what happens to us. We must move. It is not optional. The more we try to sit still, the worse the feeling gets. We have to move. And this bizarre prickly feeling might be different in different parts of our body. Usually when we're diagnosed, I think it's actually a requirement to be diagnosed. It has to be in your leg first, but the sensations can happen anywhere in our bodies. So I get it in my arms, but in my arms, it usually feels like I've got an electrical sheath that's pulsing through. I get sensations in my torso too. And in addition, I get involuntary muscle spasms. And so my leg jerks, my arm jerks, my torso will jerk so hard, it will snap me like a clamshell. It is horrendous. And this happens, this cycle will happen every single night. And because we have to move to manage the symptoms, it means we're up, walking, moving somehow all night long. My symptoms began when I was a teenager, and that was decades before there was even a name for it. And then my symptoms skyrocketed during my pregnancies. At this point, well, for many years, I've had to sleep in a separate bedroom from my husband because I'm up so often during the night that it bothers him too much. So I try to protect his sleep. I've been so exhausted and so sleep deprived at night while I'm up walking that I have fallen asleep while I'm walking. And I've nearly hit my head several times on furniture, catching myself as I crumble down, falling asleep as I'm moving. When I'm on an airplane, I'm absolutely trapped if symptoms begin. It makes people pretty nervous to see somebody walking up and down the aisle. Can't do it. So I'm moving my leg. So pity my poor seatmates. My restless leg syndrome disrupts my whole family life, vacations and holidays. I never know whether I'm going to have two brain cells to rub together. I run my own business. I have wondered at times whether I would be able to continue my business because I'm so exhausted during the day. And it doesn't help that there have been media pundits and comics who have found this as to be sort of a cause célèbre at times, because the name is pretty ridiculous, restless leg syndrome, except that it does describe exactly what this disorder is. Our legs and other parts of our bodies are restless. But when people are making fun of it, or they question saying this is just big pharma making up a disease, I assure you it is not. But then other people start to question when they feel these weird, bizarre sensations. They think, oh no, this is just something that somebody has made up and it's not real. And that prevents them from going to go get help. So if people are having weird feelings, and especially if they feel like the only way to manage it is they have to move, they need to go see their doc.
Thank you for that incredible story. Our next speaker is Emma Cooksey. She was diagnosed with obstructive sleep apnea at the age of 30 after more than a decade of unexplained health problems. Once diagnosed, she felt alone and isolated while navigating life with sleep apnea and adjusting to CPAP therapy. Emma is the host of the weekly podcast Sleep Apnea Stories, where she shares her journey, breaks down stereotypes of sleep apnea, and raises awareness of symptoms and treatment options. Emma?
So the story that I'd like to share happened when I was 30 years old and I was a new mom. I'd been out with my baby and we were coming back home. So I strapped my baby into her cow print car seat and we set off on the journey home. And we had to cross, I live in Florida, so we had to cross the Buckman Bridge in Jacksonville. It's a really long bridge that spans the St. John's River. And there's maybe like three or four lanes of traffic each side. It's really busy. And as soon as I got on that bridge, I had the feeling that I couldn't keep my eyes open. So I did what I think a lot of people can relate to, that feeling, right? You're kind of driving along and you're struggling to keep your eyes open. And so I was blowing air in my face and I was kind of tapping my cheek and trying to think of any way that I could to stay awake. And I started focusing on the really large truck in front of me. There was a white truck. And I focused on the license plate and keeping that as far away from me as possible to give me as much stopping distance as possible, because I felt certain that I was going to fall asleep. So the next moment, the license plate was coming straight towards me, super close, and I had to slam on my brakes not to hit that truck. And it was a really terrifying experience. And I drove home and my baby and I were okay by some miracle. And when I got home, I handed my baby to my husband and I had adrenaline coursing through me and tears running down my face. And I told him I have to go and call my doctor's office. So 3 weeks before this incident, I'd been sitting in my doctor's office explaining to her that I was having terrible daytime sleepiness and I was having a tough time staying awake. And I told her, I know that you're going to tell me that I have a new baby and that's why I'm feeling the way that I am, but I've been having these symptoms for years and my baby's actually sleeping through the night now and I still wake up unrefreshed even if I've slept for 8 hours. And so she had told me 3 weeks before, some of the symptoms you're talking about do sound like a sleep disorder called sleep apnea, but we don't normally see that in young, healthy women. It's more of a sort of older men, like people who are overweight and that kind of thing. So she was like, I don't think we would test you for that. And so I think that falling asleep at the wheel in my car with the baby in the car for the first time, I think I'd never fallen asleep before. I'd felt drowsy before, but there was something about the fact that I'd actually fallen asleep and my baby had been with me, gave me the momentum I needed to really push for some more answers. So after I called back the doctor's office, I said, whatever needs to happen, we need to look into my sleep more. And I was referred for a sleep study, and I got a diagnosis of obstructive sleep apnea, a condition I'd never really heard of beside my doctor saying that it's a thing that she thought I didn't have. And so that's a condition where your airway is collapsing or becoming blocked multiple times all night, cutting off the air to your or the oxygen to your brain and making you wake up multiple times. And so I had a lot of feelings about the diagnosis. So I got on treatment with CPAP, and that really extreme daytime sleepiness got better fairly quickly. So I was grateful for that. But I did have a lot of annoyance that it had taken this long, like, you know, to get a diagnosis when I'd had these symptoms for 10 years. And I'd been reading I think somebody talked about how they were looking at tips to hack their sleep. I had read every article in every magazine possible, all about, you know, sleep tips, sleep hygiene. I was doing all of those things. And I think that had I known anything about sleep disorders and that that could affect somebody like me, I would have asked more questions at the doctor's office. So my hope for journalists watching this is just to really be aware that there are so many people like me out there who could be so helped by having the right information about sleep disorders and who they affect. And I would just lastly say that for women especially, for me, I had polycystic ovarian syndrome during my 20s. And that became this kind of, well, you're tired because you have polycystic ovarian syndrome. Then I was pregnant and I was told, you're tired because you're pregnant. Then I had a newborn and was told, you're tired because you have a newborn. And a lot of women are told, you're in menopause and that's why you're tired. But sleep disorders can also be part of the picture. And so I think we just need to, you know, raise awareness and broaden how we talk about sleep to include sleep disorders like sleep apnea.
Thank you, Emma. Our next speaker is Ray Merrill. He's a patient representative actively participating in clinical studies for rapid eye movement sleep behavior disorder, RBD. Ray was diagnosed with RBD and obstructive sleep apnea in 2011. Ray has been a critical part in updating RBD clinical guidelines and is a career environmental health and safety professional who recently retired after 40 years across multiple industries. Ray was not able to join us live, but did share this video with us earlier today.
Hey, Merle. I live in New Jersey with my wife, and we raised two daughters here in the state. And I happen to have two sleep disorders. And if anyone recognizes what I'm describing to you, I really encourage you to seek medical help for it, because it's not fun gasping at night for air or throwing yourself out of bed, which I have done many, many times both. So we were raising two daughters, very busy with our careers, and I started gaining weight traveling. My first symptoms of snoring. My wife reminded me often that I would snore at night. There was a joke that I would be taking my naps on weekends, and it was fairly common in my 40s. And it wasn't until 2007, and I was just turned 50 at this point, that I had a memory of a dream enactment where I moved that was related to the dream content. And I didn't think much of it. I attributed it to stress. This happened a few times a month in 2007. And as time went on, 2008 and 2009, that was a great financial crisis. So I was under a lot of stress. I had a job transition. And my dream enactments started becoming much more frequent and active. I felt like I was in movie scenes being chased and threatened. I was defending my family or defending the house. And I found myself on the floor several times. And this was starting to occur on a weekly basis. So when I would go to bed, I wouldn't know what kind of a dream I would wake up to. And my wife got very good at playing defensive. She would catch my arms or just nudge me, just like I'm having a dream, try to get me out of it. I would often find myself going right back into the active dream, so that sometimes that wasn't always effective. We slept with a sleep pillow, body pillows between us, which wasn't the best, but that's what we were dealing with. So it wasn't until 2010, I was just 50, that I had a awakening. In traveling, I was in a hotel room and I was having a wicked dream, thrashing, throwing myself about. I don't remember the contents, but I do remember throwing myself into the corner of the nightstand, hitting myself right at the sternum in the chest, and sitting in the floor of that hotel room, turning on the light, looking at my shirt, and I broke the skin right at my sternum. I realized this was a lot more than stress. I had to take this seriously. So I got back home, went to my primary care physician. He and I had talked about my activities at night and really didn't have any recommendations, but referred me to a neurologist. So during the summer of 2007, I was 50 at this point, the neurologist set up a series of tests, one being a sleep study overnight. So I went into the sleep study, first time I've ever experienced this, and I got wired up and then asked to sleep, which was kind of crazy when you think about it, but I went to sleep fairly quickly. Halfway through the night, the technician came in and put a mask on my face. I don't remember what it was. I have very vague memories of that. But the next morning, when I woke up, I asked the technician, well, how did I do? And they didn't really tell me much other than you did much better with the mask on. So at this point, I kind of realized I had some sort of sleep apnea coming into this sleep study. But when I met with my pulmonologist, he informed me that I have two sleep disorders, the obstructive sleep apnea, which I pretty well knew I had and I should have been dealing with it over the years. But the second is a rapid eye movement sleep behavior disorder, RBD. I've never heard of these terms or this acronym before. And I was just so focused on this mask and the lifestyle, living with this mask nightly, Darth Vader, that the RBD was kind of put back in my mind. The only thing that I remember that the pulmonologist mentioned is that this could have risk consequences later in life, such as Parkinson's. That's the only term I remember. So effectively, I went into denial with RBD. I was focusing more on my CPAP, or breathing at night, and that certainly did help, help with my snoring. And the medications that prescribed, over-the-counter melatonin and then a sleep sedative, really dealt with the symptoms, but there is no treatment for RBD, the dream enactment. So at least I was no longer throwing myself out of bed and my activities at night, thrashing was minimized. I would still break through maybe once or twice a month, but nothing to the extent of throwing myself out or whacking my wife with my arms or legs. So at least it was peaceful on the home front, and I was dealing with my mask and medications with RBD. So if you recognize this story at all, that having gasping at night for air and thrashing yourself in bed, landing on the floor, throwing yourself against the wall, please seek medical attention, because it is a serious sleep disorder. Both of them are obstructive sleep apnea and rapid eye movement sleep behavior disorder. So I hope you well, and best of luck. Take care.
It is my honor to introduce our final speaker, Kristen Beecher. She is a storyteller and a news producer from Houston, Texas. She was diagnosed with narcolepsy type 2 at age 24. But had lived with the symptoms for many years before that. Kristen works daily to make sure that underrepresented voices are heard and their stories shared. She believes it is her purpose to produce content that looks like the world around us, colorful, rich, and full of light. Kristen?
Hi. So as Lindsay said, my name is Kristen. I am a journalist, specifically a news producer, and I live in Houston, Texas. And I think that as a person living with narcolepsy type 2 without cataplexy and a journalist, I have a unique perspective on why this conversation is so important. So I'm going to share about how actually working in a newsroom is what led me to get my diagnosis. I probably have had narcolepsy for the majority of my life. I don't have a time when I believe that my symptoms began, but I do remember being sleepy and unable to stay awake through most of my time in school, from grade school all the way through college. But when I was 24, I was working in my second news market. I had come home to Houston And I felt really privileged to be working in such a high market, a top 10 market at such a young age. But I was working the overnight shift, which means that I was working on a morning show when I went to sleep during the day and I worked at night. And that's hard for everybody, but I just could not adjust. And so 3 years later, I was still trying to get like used to the schedule, and that should have told me that something was wrong. But by the time I was 24, I could not get through a shift without going to sleep in the bathroom. I was going to make up excuses to go to my car and going to sleep there. I was falling asleep at my desk. And ultimately, the day that I had a horrible, I'd come to Jesus moment with my bosses was when I was sleeping in the control room. If you've never been in a news control room, it is dark, it is cold, there are a lot of repetitive sounds. And in my opinion, that's an excellent place to take a nap. If my bosses are watching this, I don't sleep in the control room anymore now that I have a diagnosis. But I was asleep in the control room. I wasn't sleeping during my newscast because it was too stressful, but like I would help out after my show and go to sleep there. One of my executive producers came and like tapped me on the shoulder and was like, "We got you, girl." Because everyone had been saying I was sleeping, and I would say, "No, I'm not sleeping. I'm like looking at my phone or I'm typing and my eyes are looking down." And so I remember I had to sign a contract, and it was so crazy because I didn't even sign a contract to work at that station. And in a lot of news, you sign contracts, but I had to sign a contract explaining that I understood that it was not okay to sleep. The language was unacceptable. I couldn't sleep at my desk. I couldn't sleep in the bathroom. I couldn't even go to the car on my lunch break and sleep. And as a journalist, we don't even get lunch breaks. So I was like, that's ridiculous. You didn't even need to tell me that. So I just knew that sleeping was not acceptable, but I couldn't figure out how to not be sleepy. I'd always been sleepy. I thought that everyone was just as sleepy as I was, but I wasn't doing the right things to handle my sleepiness. And I remember coming home and being like, "Mommy, I have to figure something out. I need to get a doctor's note to explain what's going to happen. So that my job doesn't fire me, because this is the only thing I've ever wanted to do in my entire life is be a journalist, and I would hate to lose it because I can't stay awake." And that's what ultimately led me to my diagnosis of narcolepsy. But I understand my position and my purpose in a newsroom. I'm a woman, Black, first generation college graduate. I am a child of immigrants. I was raised by a single mom. I understand how to advocate for the different intersections in which I reside. And I understand that having those experiences also make me able to advocate for people with experiences that I've never had. But I have to be educated about those experiences before I can advocate for them, before I can say, "We need to do a story on this," before I can say, "Hey, we're not covering the story in the right way. We're making light of it, or we're spreading false information or not telling the full story." But I was a person who had no idea about anything about sleep disorders, that I couldn't even advocate for myself or have an informed conversation amongst my colleagues in the newsroom. So I know for sure that we were not having informed conversations with news that we were putting out to our viewers in the fourth largest city in America. And I've always watched news, and I never saw any stories about anything past making sure that you're sleeping, you know, with the temperature in your room in a certain way, making sure you have nice sheets and you have your blue light glasses on. These are blue light glasses because I follow the sleep hygiene things too. If I had heard stories like mine, like Lauren's, like Reverend Kreftsman's, like Emma's, if I had heard those stories, if I had met Julie before I was diagnosed, I could have been diagnosed so much earlier. And I could have been working to do more stories and actually making impactful conversations about sleep health on the airwaves across my city. I've worked in different cities. I could have been doing this in other markets. I'm so happy that I am diagnosed now, and that I am able to have these conversations. And I hope that journalists watching this remember the stories that we told here, and remember that we do have a job and we have a purpose to give informed information to people and make sure that we're telling the full story, like Julie was saying. So not just telling about sleep hygiene, but even if it's just one line, if none of this works for you, maybe talk to your doctor. That could really help someone. Thank you.
Thank you, Kristen. That was such a perfect way to sum up what we've been talking about. And I want to invite all of our participants to come back and join us because I have some questions for y'all. Kristen mentioned what she wished that she had read when she was in this place on her diagnosis. And I'm curious for the rest of our speakers, when you were trying to be diagnosed, because across all of our stories, we have a theme that it took a really long time and it feels like you found the end of the internet trying to look for answers.
And I'm curious, what is that thing that you wish you had read that could have possibly got you there quicker?
Well, I'll start and I'll just say it's not a maybe what I read. I think it's, for me, this would be my biggest tip, is about the photos that you're sharing in articles. So often any article about narcolepsy is a person asleep over their laptop. And I was in law school when I was diagnosed with narcolepsy, and I was typing on my laptop, but I wasn't necessarily putting my head down on top of my laptop. I was in the bathroom trying to wake myself up, and I was really just like not really there in class, but my hands were typing. My brain was just like on another planet. And I think those visuals are really important, and just not going to the most extreme. You know, this, and so we talk about this in the toolkit, and we have image examples of things maybe to steer away from and ideas that we like better. And I would just say, just trying to not sensationalize these so much, because then it kind of makes it otherworldly. It's like, wow, that's so extreme. That person's asleep over their laptop. That's not me, you know, and it can be subtle. Or like Kristen was saying, that she thought she was looking down at her phone almost when she was sleeping. Like, you know, it can be really quite hard for us to even figure out, or we're really good at trying to hide it. So, and it's not normal to like fall asleep in public, and we know that. And so we are like doing all these other coping ways. So that would just be like my biggest tip, would just be about the images that are associated with articles.
I think I might add, because my story is a little bit different, that I wasn't diagnosed until my mid-30s. So I'd had RLS for at least 20 years. But I got diagnosed because my husband was a second career medical student. And so we were a little older at the time. So he came home from school one day and he said, "I think I know what you've got." And that's what then I started going to docs and neurologists and so on. But my point in bringing that up is that especially women are, as so many of these stories have said, have in some way insinuated, we're making this up. And for all of those years, what I kept telling myself with these weird feelings was, it's all in my head. I'm making this up, because it was, RLS symptoms are often so silly. It's really hard to take them seriously. And then you've got a society that says women shouldn't be taking themselves seriously. So I would not have gone to a doctor had my husband not said, "I think you've actually got something medical happening with you." So if you are, if all of the normal things like sleep hygiene isn't working, or you've got a persistent issue that keeps coming up, you're not making it up. Take yourself seriously, respect your own body and listen to it, and start knocking on doors and keep knocking on doors until you get somebody to give you an answer.
Yeah, amen to Reverend Lisa. That was everything. I just have to kind of echo what everyone has said so far, but I feel like there was a time where friends, professors, maybe even my parents kind of thought that I could pick and choose when my sleepiness would come, because, you know, sometimes I could do the fun things, but it was really hard for me to wake up in time for class. It was really hard for me to make an early flight. You know, I couldn't drive on the road trip. You know, it was kind of like I would, you know, have these episodes of intense sleepiness, you know, but it seemed like it was very convenient. And I feel like a lot of times I felt very shamed, and then it forced me to hide, to try and conceal and hide the sleepiness as best I could, because I wouldn't want to be called lazy. I wouldn't want to say, you know, I'm picking and choosing when I can be tired. And I think, you know, to kind of echo what Lisa was saying, if this is something that's, you know, happening, persisting, you really have to believe yourself, trust in yourself, and advocate for yourself, because no one else is going to do it for you.
Absolutely. Emma, do you have something you want to share?
So it kind of, a lot of people have mentioned the mental health aspect of this. And I think that just rang so true for me. Like during my 20s, I was dealing with anxiety and depression. And I don't know whether it's women and men or what, but I know that as soon as there was any element of anxiety and depression on my chart, it felt as though I would go with other symptoms. And because there's this bi-directional relationship between mental health and sleep, you know, people would just kind of fixate on the mental health part and would just be like, well, you know, if you have that diagnosis of anxiety and depression, that's probably why your sleep is a problem. So I think just echoing what everybody said about really advocating for yourself and realizing that a lot of primary care physicians don't have a lot of training in sleep specifically. And so really pushing to be referred to a sleep specialist would be my biggest advice for people. And to write articles about that those sleep specialists exist.
And to add to that, if you don't mind. So a lot of primary care doctors don't have training in sleep. But I would also argue that there are I love psychiatrists. I'm a psychologist. I work with psychiatry all the time. There are plenty of psychiatrists who really have very little training in sleep too. And there's still that old school model that I'm fighting against in lectures all the time, when I'm teaching newer students in the field, is that you can have anxiety and depression and a sleep disorder. It doesn't mean that it's just anxiety and depression that's causing it, or maybe the sleep disorder might be assuming that it's anxiety or depression. So it's really, I always rule out sleep disorders before I automatically go and assume there's anything else going on first. Maybe they're both occurring, but I want to make sure that nothing medical is going on, even as a psychologist, to rule it all out.
I was just going to say, it's worth saying, Shelby, that you can treat everything, right? You can be treating the anxiety and depression and the sleep disorder. And you know, certainly for me, that's been the best solution, you know?
And if we get the proper diagnosis when it comes to sleep, for some people, you treat the sleep, guess what? It might make it easier to treat the anxiety and depression if that's going on as well.
And I'd love to follow up on that. Lauren talked about this. This was an issue for me about getting diagnosed with anxiety long before a sleep disorder. And unfortunately, not all of our doctors were as incredible as you are. What are your tips for how to talk about this if you have been diagnosed with anxiety or depression and still not feeling like this is solving an issue with either how you're sleeping at night or, you know, how you're feeling during the day in terms of your wakefulness?
So I think if you're concerned that your anxiety and depression is just, you're working on that, but it's not doing anything for the sleep, what my advice for every single person that I work with, and I have to remind myself of this sometimes from time to time, is that you are the expert on you. And if you feel like the needle is not moving in any direction, then you need to keep speaking up until you hear someone or you have someone who's actually going to take you seriously. So you can keep doing the same treatments over and over again, whether it's for a mood disorder or whatever else. But if that's not helping your primary complaint, then you need to find someone who's going to take that primary complaint seriously.
And adding to that, you know, we've heard several people talk about some of their sleep or wakefulness issues being conflated with being a woman. I know when I was really trying to get a diagnosis in my early 30s, I got told that it was probably a hormone change. This is what getting older feels like. How do you sort of work in the system around that?
I think for me, it's been a challenge. So one of my areas of specialty is insomnia and women who are perimenopausal and menopausal. And I think it was really a challenge to find people who were well-versed in that up until maybe like 4 or 5 years ago. Finally, it's interesting. I mean, I think with the work that Project Sleep's doing, there are various advocacy groups that are really speaking out and educating more. So you're seeing it starting to change in the perimenopause, menopause space, right? That it's not necessarily all anxiety and depression and in someone's head necessarily. And so they're working and talking about hormone replacement and all these other things that were kind of very taboo for a long time are now much more in the mainstream. And I think that that's something that it's hopefully getting easier for people to talk about when it comes to sleep disorders, and that it's not just automatically assumed that it's, you know, other things going on mental health wise. But I think that's slowly changing. And then hopefully with this talks like this, that narrative when it comes to other areas of sleep medicine are going to start changing as well in sleep disorders.
Well, I think that is an incredible place for us to bring this conversation to a close. These resources from Project Sleep are continuing to grow every day. And if there is information that you need as a journalist that you're not seeing on the Project Sleep website, please reach out because we can help you find it. And we hope that everyone out there is getting some good sleep and hopefully finding the resources they need if they're not. So thank you so much.
The Project Sleep Podcast is produced by Carver Sound Productions For more information on podcast production services, visit carversoundproductions.com.